I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The poet Robert Lowell was the last of his kind, a New England aristocrat of Olympian thunder and civic weight, dead set from boyhood on artistic greatness. The pure air of the mountain peak, he said. All the while he was beset by certifiable madness, crippling peaks of mania and depression. He knew the humiliation of the straitjacket and the padded cell. 20 hospital stays in 20 years, he counted at one point. And still, the man of grisly bear force and delicate nerves kept writing. The turn underway in Robert Lowell's reputation is not the wheel of fashion at work. It's a creative insight that lets all of us see art and madness in the context of one man's character that held it together.
My mind's not right. A car radio bleats love, oh careless love. I hear my ill spirit sob in each blood cell as if my hand were at its throat. I myself am hell, nobody's here.
Lowell had madness not just in his bloodstream and all through his poems, but in his epic vision too, of himself, of his lordly New England roots, and his country in trouble. Kay Redfield Jamison is the muse of this hour, doctor, writer, psychoanalyst, and teacher, who lives with much the same manic depressive illness that afflicted Robert Lowell. For all of us, she has written a biography of one artist's simmering brain, what Lowell called his triple conflict of madness, death, and life. On the way to Kay Jamison, I asked the poet Dan Chasen, who writes on poetry in the New Yorker magazine, to reset Robert Lowell in our landscape.
Well, here's what's new these days with Lowell. I can teach Lowell confidently, and my students are moved by Lowell, I think, more readily than they have been in a long time.
How's that?
Well, Kay Jamison's book, I think one of the great virtues of this book is that it brings to light just how severe, how desperate his bipolar disorder was. Students, after all, don't automatically take to an aristocratic white man who in some ways saw himself as emblematic or representative of the whole nation. But when you really look at the work through this new lens, I think you see that he was first and foremost a sufferer, a profound sufferer. There's an element of courage just putting pen to paper for him. Now I have this book that I can refer to and that I can quote from, and I think it's really helpful in just characterizing him as a human who wasn't, you know, always imperious and always entitled and always privileged.
He's risen above his aristocracy in a sense.
Yes, or below, I don't know. Yes, absolutely. He took the fluctuations and ups and downs of his own mind as his subject. Hopkins says the mind has mountains, and he's the great, I think, mental mountain climber. Because his suffering from his mental illness was so severe, he also has a incredibly wide, broad spectrum of emotional response that he can call up in his poems. He's experienced what it's like to be healthy. He's experienced what it's like to be in decline for his mind and his behavior to speed up. He knows what it is to be committed to a mental asylum. He knows what it's like to recover, but to fear that the cycles are just going to repeat themselves. And so I find just the amount of anguish and kind of access to anguish in his work inspiring.
I read him through Kay Jamison's book, for sure, as kind of, this is the ultimate Boston story.
Absolutely.
It goes back to the Mayflower, is full of the glories of the 19th century Brahminocracy, and then it's collapse in the 20th century.
Right.
It encompasses everything.
Yeah, and he's the last man standing. He's the designated mourner for Brahmin culture in Boston.
That's perfect.
And it makes him such a mordant and in some ways very darkly funny writer. The kind of ironies of circumstance, kind of growing up in the decline of being on the wrong side of Beacon Hill, still surrounded by like the trappings of Boston aristocracy, but it really couldn't be capitalized in the same way, I think, that it had been, you know, in generations prior.
And then he finds himself at McLean among the, what did you call them?
Mayflower screwballs, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But also, the other piece of it is his incredible ambition. He
yes.
wants to be John Milton, if
Absolutely.
Not Dante.
You know, he writes a letter when he's 19 years old from Wigglesworth Hall at Harvard to Ezra Pound in Italy, asking to come and study with Ezra Pound, and going on and on about how he prefers the religion of the ancient Greeks to his parents' Episcopalianism. So,
yeah, forgive me, but the Boston angle, that's Ted Williams at 19 saying, all I want is when I go down the street, people say, that's the greatest hitter that ever lived.
I think that's Lowell. Absolutely. That's the essence of Lowell. And it's stirring to be in the presence of that kind of ambition on the page. I think you mentioned Milton, and Milton comes to mind right away, particularly in the early verse, which is so learned and allegorical. And there are these poems about Boston where Boston is really just a landscape full of symbols. And he's also has the misfortune of being in and out of hospitals almost his entire life. So from the age of, I think it's 38 on, he was institutionalized regularly. I mean, there were very few periods in his life with his wife, Elizabeth Hardwick, when they weren't in some kind of trouble. So I do think that he is grieving not only the decline of his race or class, but also for his own early hopes, ambitions. You know, starting out, he didn't know that his life was going to take this terrifically torturous kind of cyclical path.
Maybe he did.
Well, that's also comes out of the biography, which begins with a very vivid story about his ancestor, Harriet Lowell, being committed to McLean's, which was in Somerville at the time. And it turns out that when Lowell looks at his own family's past, but even just the past of the region, he's looking everywhere for signs of bipolar disorder. He finds traces of his own condition in Percival Lowell, his ancestor who discovered Pluto or had a hand in discovering Pluto. His own mother had periods that Jameson suggests were manic. She, at one point, tried to imitate the habits of Napoleon, bathing in the same way, you know, being totally obsessed by Napoleon. There's a lot of suicide. There's a lot of institutionalization in Lowell's past.
I love your line about history meeting heredity.
Yeah, that's right. He was looking for clues as to why he was the way he was. He's a great prose writer, too. You know, his great impressionistic essays about, particularly about New England writers. And he's looking for the same kind of material in everyone. You know, Hawthorne, for example, he's interested in the way he managed to be a family man, even in the winds of his terrible black moods. And he loved Henry Adams, who's one of the great depressives, I think, in American literature, maybe any literature.
He's looking for models, including how did other people,
yes.
going back to Homer or Alexander the Great,
yeah.
how did they deal with my confusion?
In a way, he assembles for himself a kind of ancestry, not only his own blood ancestry, but his imagination's ancestry.
He looks to me like the Elliot Richardson of high art, of poetry, of literature. Elliot Richardson, another aristocratic first-class brain with towering ambition. He wanted to be president.
Yes.
The way Lowell wanted to be Ezra Pound, at least.
Yes, that's right. And Lowell actually came very close to power in many cases. He campaigned with Eugene McCarthy. He has beautiful elegies for Bobby Kennedy, for example. I mean, there was not much electable about Robert Lowell, but there was the, I think, thrill of being close to power.
Yeah.
After John Kennedy was murdered, he was seen places and taken places by Jacqueline Kennedy, which has to be like the greatest thing that ever happened to a poet, I think.
You know, other poets would write a letter to the newspaper about wars they didn't like. He wrote personal letters to the President of the United States.
That's right.
Roosevelt in 43.
That's
Lyndon
right.
Johnson in 67.
And when he was jailed as a CO during World War II, I believe it appeared on the front page of the New York Times, not the Boston Globe, the New York Times. And he was in Life magazine. He was as famous, I think, as any American poet has ever been, maybe.
When you look at the poetry today, Dan Chasen, what jumps out?
Today being this absolute current moment in history and time and space where I'm so preoccupied with my own grief over the country and the direction it seems to be headed in, what I find is that he brought this extraordinary, troubled, self-reflective mind to bear thinking about politics, thinking about civics, and he loved history his whole life. You know, he memorized the names of all of Napoleon's generals when he was like 8 years old or something. Mm. So he can bring all of it up to bear on the contemporary scene. I think he shows us how an American personal life can be a nexus of political trouble, political energy, political engagement. He had an omnivorous, rapid mind so that he often wrote very soon after the moment, if not in the moment.
What is that civic poet saying to us in his work, but also in his memory?
Well, I think he up and speaks, whether it's for the Union Dead. That's one of the great statements, I think, about how not far we'd come since the end of the Civil War. It's probably the great poem about the Civil War from the Union side, but also about the civil rights struggle. So he just gives voice to all of these matters of civic and communal and popular concern, which is unusual, I think, for poets.
What's he saying?
Well, he's almost never saying one thing, but he's showing how a mind might organize, make shapes out of the news, history, public conflicts. This is an elegy for Bobby Kennedy, just simply called RFK, 1925 to 1968. And I think it shows you how primarily personal poetry, really emphatically personal poetry, can be, I guess you'd say, political or be engaged with political emotions. Here in my study, in its listlessness of vacancy, some old Victorian house, airtight and sheeted for old summers, far from the hornet yatter of the bond, is loneliness, a thin smoke thread of vital air. What can I catch from you now? Doom was woven in your nerves, your shirt, woven in the great clan. They too were loyal. You too were more than loyal to them, to death. For them, like a prince, you daily left your tower to walk through dirt in your best cloth. Here now, alone, in my Plutarchan bubble, I miss you, you out of Plutarch, made by hand, forever approaching our maturity.
Dan Chasen is the New Yorker poetry critic and professor of English at Wellesley College. Coming up, Kay Redfield Jamison's account of Robert Lowell, starting from his line, setting the river on fire. Her line is a study of genius, mania, and character. Emphasis on character. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Robert Lowell, Reconsidered.
All autumn, the chafe and jar of nuclear war. We have talked our extinction to death. A father's no shield for his child. We're like a lot of wild spiders crying together, but without tears.
How do we make some integrated sense today of Robert Lowell, the poet that Seamus Heaney pictured as an egotistical sublime, writing as if he intended to be heard in a high wind? Lowell, who set himself in one poem among the thoroughbred mental cases in McLean Hospital. We asked our favorite reader of modern poetry, Stephen, also known as Steph Burt, to give us Lowell today.
There's so much Lowell, and one of the things I value about him is his constant attempts to reinvent himself. He's always setting himself up as the great inheritor of power, of a Western, very sort of loud, orchestrated, post-Miltonic tradition of poems that work like invading armies, of poems that work like thunder, of poems that announce what's right and what's wrong and what happened. And at the same time, in every one of Lowell's phases, he is disassembling that weaponry. He is stepping back from himself. He is undermining himself. He is saying, what? No. And he is our great American poet of self-reproach, of violently mixed feelings, of disowning power, which he knew that he had sonically, rhetorically, and also, of course, socially, because he was the inheritor of so much privilege. And that impulse to recognize and disown your own exceptional power speaks to Lowell's sonic toolkit, which he developed by reading the people he read early on, Milton and Hopkins and Alan Tate, for that matter, and Eliot. But it also speaks to Lowell's relationship to his own bipolar illness. Lowell, in his own adult life, was regularly feeling like the most powerful, most important, smartest, most creative person in the world, and then realizing that those feelings came from a problem in the molecular biology of his brain and could harm people if he acted on them. So that impulse to demonstrate and to disown one's own power, which you feel in the movement of Lowell's lines and of Lowell's rhetoric, is also an impulse that you can see operating throughout Lowell's adult life.
Do you want to give us a poem?
I would love to. This one's good. This is one of the ones from the book about his New York family called For Lizzie and Harriet. And in the version printed here, he called it The Hard Way. I love this opening, The Hard Way. Harriet. Don't hate your parents, or your children will hire unknown men to bury you at your own cost. Child, 40 years younger, will we live to see your destiny written by our hands rewritten? Your adolescence snap the feathered barb, the phosphorescence of your wake. Under the stars, one sleeps, is free from household, tufts of grass and dust and tufts of grass, night oriented to the star of youth. I only learn from error. Till lately I trusted in the practice of my hand. In backward Maine, ice goes in season to the tropical, then the mash freezes back to ice, and then the ice is broken by another wave. I love that poem for the self-reproach. I love that poem for the way it moves from admonition to image. I also love it for the way that it describes Lowell's own practice of writing in those years, where he's constantly looking at what he just wrote and saying, do I believe that? Do I need to contradict it? Can I append the opposite half-truth, where he's seeing his own lines as stackable contradictions rather than as cumulative argument or description? And of course, I think he learned to write that way partly by seeing in his own life so many things that were mistakes, so many things he wanted to take back. That is a quality that is special in reading late Lowell.
That's just perfect. It connects so well with things he said about dreading the next episode.
Yep.
Not only for itself, but for having to apologize for the awful things he would do in it.
Yep. And he knew that no episode would necessarily be the last. That quality of being sonically emphatic, but emotionally and intellectually provisional, that so many of his endings have, speaks to, I think, to his sense of his own life. And it's so not a life that anybody would want. If you look at Elizabeth Bishop's elegy for him, right? Fun, it always seemed to leave you at a loss. And Bishop's sense also, that poem North Haven is so alert to Lowell's own sense that he would never find his final form, not only because he was ambitious, but because he was always doing and saying things that he might have to take back. And the famous line from Bishop's poem North Haven, repeat, 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 revise, 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 and then the way it ends, sad friend, you cannot change.
Steph Burt's new book titled The Poem Is You is a pathway to scores of contemporary poems and poets. You can listen to them on our website at radioopensource.org. And now, Kay Redfield Jameson, historian of madness in art. Before this, an acclaimed study called Touched by Fire, about the painter Van Gogh and the poet Lord Byron, among others. She's been a best-selling student of her own unquiet mind, too.
I think Lowell had an extraordinary amount of personal courage. He knew very young that he would need it to survive, and he looked to others who had shown it. I think in this day and age, we forget or tend to overlook the importance of courage and heroes both.
Spell that out, just what it was that was challenging him to his best and how he did it.
He had this remarkable capacity, all of his friends and students and fellow poet said, this remarkable capacity to travel in history, to be a part of the 19th century, to be a part of Roman times or Greek times. He could transport himself in a way to situations that were perilous and see how others had handled it. And that was very important to him.
Who were the others?
Oh, everyone from Achilles to Alexander the Great. So when he was well, which was most of the time, he looked to these people as examples and throughout literature and history. But when he was manic and delusional, he often became these people. So he became Achilles. He became Alexander the Great. So in a way, he took that kind of bolus of knowledge of living in someone's head and body and took that into his ongoing life.
You're trying to correct an impression here. What was the mistaken view?
One biography was actually quite damaging to Lowell.
Ian Hamilton.
Ian Hamilton's 1982 biography. He, at the end of the day, didn't like Lowell. He didn't like his poetry. He didn't like the way he went through life. What he wrote was rather manicured, and Lowell was, if nothing else, swinging for the fences always and trying new things. And I think he didn't understand Lowell's character.
He didn't forgive Lowell.
No, he didn't.
What must be forgiven in Lowell, but also in other great artists, maybe in all of us?
One of the things that Lowell did, which almost everyone who ever gets manic does, is say really painful, awful, cutting things. And, you know, no matter how much people know that he had an illness that made him do those things, it's impossible not to take those things personally. I think what Lowell's friends were very good at, because they knew and loved him and they saw the other side of him, was to put that in the context of who Lowell was, that it was an illness beyond his control.
Instances of the cutting things he could say.
He would make fun of people's poetry. So if you have one of the most famous poets in the world who's unusually articulate and unusually observant, going for the throat, that's pretty painful. I mean, and pretty public. He did these things publicly.
But to whom? Remind us.
Well, he did it to most people around him. He did it at cocktail parties. He did it at dinner parties. He was scathing to his wives in a very public sort of way. He humiliated them with affairs that were very public affairs. And these things are very hard to see as not under conscious will, even though, you know, for thousands of years, it's been noted in the medical literature that this is exactly what people do when they're manic. They have affairs, they say awful things, they do awful things, they can get physically violent and often do.
It's a tricky subject. I'm thinking Derek Walcott, who speaks so beautifully of Lowell and forgives him everything, but also says he's a much sweeter, dearer, better man than people knew. Derek Walcott's just died, and it was required to be dragged through his obituary that he had misbehaved.
Yes.
In all sorts of ways. Some people get forgiven, some don't.
Right.
Some people are more forgivable than others. Why do you and so many others cut Lowell a lot of slack?
For one thing, he was a tremendous friend. People who knew him really loved him. If you look at the people who were his pallbearers, several of them were his school friends. He kept friendships. He put a huge premium on loyalty. He was kind to people. He was generous to people. I mean, if you read the life of Elizabeth Bishop, every 5 pages or so, Lowell has lined her up a fellowship, lined her up a teaching position, lined her up.
How they adored each other.
That's right. And she said, you know, after he died, that she was only then even beginning to see the extent of the generosity that he never talked about to her. So, and I think he did that for a lot of people.
She also said, must have been impatiently, you're the luckiest poet that ever lived. You have every advantage, including that name, including private income, including endless friends, Harvard connections, blah, blah, blah. Other people saw Seamus Heaney, for example, in another book, not yours, talked about how he could be manipulative, very incredibly competitive, sometimes cruel.
I think he had great advantage, great privilege. I mean, much more importantly, he had great genius. I think he was dealt a very complicated hand of advantage and pain. And it was the deftness and strength of character that he had to deal with all that, but it was not a straightforward one.
Kay Jamison, the last time we spoke, we were talking about your book on mania. And I'm dying to know what somebody who's been there can tell us about the onset of these fearsome attacks that Lowell experienced and wrote about?
Mania is very seductive, and it tends to slip into you without your being aware it has slipped into you. Mm. So it's very hard to think you're ill when you're feeling better than you've ever felt in your life. Mm. So you feel extraordinary power. Your thinking is fluid. Everything is easy. Life is easy. Got 1,000 ideas a minute, all of them absolutely wonderful and extraordinary and life-saving. Of course, they're not in the light of day, but on the way up is quite extraordinary feeling. Then things begin to splinter, and you know, you start off with just having a lot of thoughts, and then all of a sudden you have far too many thoughts, and it's terrifying and frightening. And you can often become paranoid and belligerent, violent, whatever. It's a frightening disease. And I think one of the reasons I wanted to spend so much time on mania is partly because it was important to Lowell and to his work, but also because I think we have more of a notion of what depression is. Most people have more of a personal sense of melancholia, less so with mania.
There was that first bout at Yaddo when he was obviously a star young writer, but things went exactly as you're describing, too good to be true, and then a horrible crash.
I mean, sometimes it just escalates and the person is completely out of control and has no recognition that they're out of control. I think for a lot of Lowell's friends, initially they just passed it off as he was being his usual intense self, only speeded up a lot. And then at some point when he was talking about seeing the devil behind potted plants at the faculty club, people began to cotton on to the fact that, you know, things were not all right. And then when he was admitted to the hospital, he was not only the Messiah, but he told his doctors that he'd walked on the Sea of Galilee and seen green men and hallucinated and been delusional, and they gave him shock treatment at that time.
What do you say, 20 hospitals, 20 years? I mean, to the end, he didn't feel he was clear of the disease.
He did for a while, for several years, when he was on lithium, and then he got quite toxic on lithium. He just went through the arc of modern treatments. Shock treatment actually works for acute mania, worked for him. It just doesn't prevent future episodes. So it was the only thing that could turn his mania around, and it did. And it got him out of a hospital and back into life, but then the illness came back. It was only when he was given lithium that prevented future episodes.
Come to the point of the art, the genius, as you say, and the mania. Do you have a theory where his mania and his art began? What was the seed of it?
Well, I think his mania was genetic. Bipolar illness is really genetic. I traced it back in his family, on both sides of his family, several hundred years.
Right.
So the question is, in case of someone like Robert Lowell, what is it that made him the way he was? And I think from the time he was a child, he had a very tempestuous personality and character, which probably saved him. He fought everything that was in his environment.
Including his father. And that's an important
very definitely,
moment.
Yes.
19 years old, his father doesn't approve of his girlfriend at school, and he comes home and knocks him to the floor, and then some.
And he knocked him to the floor, and his father thought he should be put in an asylum.
Committed, yeah.
And he felt remorse for that act for the rest of his life, but he also wrote about it. Mm. It came out in his poetry over
Let's give his mother a little equal time. I mean, she was a monster in her own right.
She's pretty.
Kept telling him he was unwanted.
Yes, over and over again. I think his father was not a monster. I think his father was ineffectual.
Amazing moment in the memoir of Revere Street when his father leaves the house and his mother addresses only son Bobby, says, "Phew, finally, what a relief to have a real man in the house." And he plaintively says to her, in effect, "Mommy, I'm not a man, I'm a boy."
Exactly, yes.
It's almost the whole story right there.
It really is. And the difference between that and a lot of childhoods that are unhappy and cold and fraught is that Lowell observed it so coolly, in a way, and with such emotion at the same time. So he had that capacity to stand back and observe and describe, but it never left him. And again, to his dying day, he was writing poetry about his mother's making clear. In every hospitalization, there's some note by the doctor, this child was unwanted. He was an unwanted child. Painful to read.
Kay Jamison, I just got to say, I think there's a sort of social epic implied by all of this. And an apocalypse, a Boston apocalypse and a Lowell family apocalypse. They can see the end coming. And Robert Lowell is their pilot. He's out there feeling it in himself. He's feeling it in the crash of his family, including mother and father. And he's feeling it in the society. He may even be feeling it in the country. I mean, that most famous poem for the Union Dead is all about a kind of horrific degeneration of things he treasured. Can you imagine thinking of it as a kind of an apocalypse?
I do. I absolutely do. And the fact that For the Union Dead has Hiroshima in it. And the other thing about Lowell is that he turned to Hawthorne a lot. Hawthorne was dark-minded as well, but he had used Hawthorne's writings to describe the ability of New England and America to come back when necessary, that the spirit of New England, that as soon as we set foot at Plymouth, things went downhill in terms of moral decline. But he also said, you know, every time that happens and we go too far and we get too degenerate, something of the original spirit comes back. And now, one day, it may be too far and we can't come back. But I end up reading from For the Union Dead as some sort of sense that we do and will come back, but we also will always push our luck and go too far.
Kay Redfield Jamison teaches psychiatry at Johns Hopkins Medical School in Baltimore. Coming up, the play of light and shadow on Robert Lowell from his great friend Elizabeth Bishop. This is Open Source. A great deal of what keeps Lowell in play today is the closeness and the contrast in his friendship with Elizabeth Bishop, conducted mostly by mail. Her poetry is more read than his nowadays. In the beginning, it was an instant artistic match in which he seemed to be encouraging her. Megan Marshall wrote the new Bishop biography titled A Miracle for Breakfast, in which Lowell is a main supporting player.
They really met because they had two important books coming out the same year in 1946, Lowell's Lord Wearies Castle and Elizabeth Bishop's first book of poems, North and South. And they were reviewed together sometimes. Lowell's book went on to win the Pulitzer Prize, I think. That was his first Pulitzer. And they met as a result of this. Randall Jarrell, who had reviewed Bishop's book, thought they should meet, and they met in his apartment. She liked his disheveled appearance and his boyish ways, and he found her shy and neat and careful, but I think he was challenged to penetrate her reserve. And they did fall into conversation very easily. And she said afterwards she'd never really talked so openly with a poet about how poetry was made, how it was constructed. You know, the famous confessional vein that is associated so much with Robert Lowell, I think, was set off in part by Elizabeth Bishop's story in The Village, a prose poem, as her editor, Catherine White, described it, recalling her painful but also idyllic childhood in Great Village, Nova Scotia, around age 4 and 5, as her mother was going mad and being institutionalized. Lowell loved that story so much, he actually wrote a poem based on it called The Scream. In the story, she described the sound of her mother's screams echoing over the village, even after her mother was taken away. And it prompted him, I think, to write his 91 Revere Street memoir, which was so important to him. They both said to the other, you should turn this into a novel, you should make it a bigger thing. So they really followed each other's work. I mean, after that 1947 meeting at Randall Jarrell's, Elizabeth published a really remarkable poem, At the Fish Houses, a very wise, philosophical, deep poem that doesn't say much about herself, but Lowell loved that and, you know, thought it was her best and wrote to her right away and initiated this correspondence that went on really through all their lives and was perhaps the most meaningful connection they had. There were these two kind of key encounters in Maine that became the stuff of poetry in a way for Lowell in particular, that summer after they met at Randall Jarrell's, Elizabeth had rented an apartment on the coast of Maine and invited various friends to come by. And they both kicked out their lover or paramour, whatever it may be, and ended up with an afternoon together on the shore. And this is a moment that Lowell commemorated in a poem called Water. And he also, 10 years later, when they met again in Maine, it seems that Lowell had become amorous towards Bishop at that point. We don't really know what happened, but he wrote a really extraordinary letter afterwards saying that her presence there reminded him of that day in 1947 when they had been alone on the shore of Maine. Perhaps, he said, I assumed that, you know, the next thing would be that we'd be married.
Castine, Maine, August 9, 1957. Dear Elizabeth.
Lowell's letters to Bishop are now the stuff of literary readings.
I want you to know, oh dear, I wanted you to know so many things. Do you remember how at the end of that long swimming and sunning Stonington day, we went up to, I think, the relatively removed Upper Gross house and had one of those real fried New England dinners, probably awful. And we were talking about this and that about ourselves, and you said, rather humorously, yet it was truly meant, when you write my epitaph, you must say I was the loneliest person who ever lived. Probably you forget. And anyway, all that is mercifully changed, and all has come right since you found Lotta. But at the time, our relations seemed to have reached a new place. I assumed that it would be just a matter of time before I proposed, and I half believed that you would accept. Well, I didn't say anything then, and then there was that poetry conference at Bard, and I remember one evening presided over by Mary McCarthy, and going home to the Bard Poets' dormitory, I was so drunk that my hands turned cold, and I felt half dying and held your hand. And nothing was said. And like a loon that needs 60 feet, I believe, to take off from the water, I wanted time and space and went on assuming. And when I was to have joined you at Key West, I was determined to ask you. Then, of course, the Yaddo explosion came and all was over. So it is. Let me say this, though, and then leave the matter forever. I do think free will is sown into everything we do. You can't cross a street, light a cigarette, drop saccharin in your coffee without really doing it. Yet the possible alternatives that life allows us are very few. But asking you is the might have been for me, the one towering change, the other life that might have been had. It was that way for these 9 years or so that intervened. It was deeply buried. And this spring and summer, really before your arrival, it boiled to the surface. Now, it won't happen again, though, of course, I always feel a great blitheness and easiness with you. It won't happen. I'm really, underneath, utterly, in love and sold on my Elizabeth, and it's a great solace to me that you are with Lotta. And I am sure it is the will of the heavens that all is as it is.
In Lowell's poem called Water, he ends like this: we wished our two souls might return like gulls to the rock. In the end, the water was too cold for us.
Yes, they had gone to the beach, and they had apparently, you know, talked rather endlessly and happily. But again, it was a sort of backward-glancing moment, even as it was happening, I think. You know, they both had other lives that they were going to go on to live, perhaps only vaguely sensed at that point. But, you know, it's really clear from the new material that's emerged in the Bishop archive that she was loved women from, you know, girlhood. And that was where she found her happiness. She wasn't going to be altered in that way. And Lowell was, I keep trying to find the right term for this in our 21st century parlance, but there was a phrase that came up at mid-century, their time, of being highly sexed. I think both Bishop and Lowell were highly sexed, but in different directions.
Right, not compatibly.
They weren't going to come together in that way.
Kay Redfield Jameson has written this book, raising the profoundest questions and fascinating ones about madness and art and also bad behavior. What's forgivable? When is the man acting? When is the mania acting?
Mm-hmm.
How do you judge it from a Bishop perspective.
Well, you know, Bishop's mother went insane and was institutionalized, but she had a horror of mental illness, even as she was drawn to people who were a little bit on the edge, as perhaps maybe many of the poets of this generation were. Elizabeth Bishop,
yeah.
Yes. So she was, I think, cautious around Lowell once his depressions and manias really manifest, which was not until after that first meeting on the shore in 1947. She felt for him. She felt an incredible, I would say, compassion, empathy for the times that he was overcome, even as she didn't really, of course, want to be close enough to it. I mean, there were so many suicides among this group of people, Jarrell, Sexton, and the terrible death of Dylan Thomas. There was an interesting letter between Lowell and Bishop about that, where Lowell says he burned too bright. Don't let this happen to you. He was aware of Bishop's own drinking problem. That was her problem. And I think in some ways, maybe she was a little relieved that she didn't go mad like her mother. Mm. She really was determined to hang on to her sanity, and she knew when she needed help for her alcoholism, sometimes checked herself into a hospital to dry out, even though she really could never kick it.
Remind me, Megan Marshall, seriously, why do we invest such authority in these people who are nuts and troubled and drunk and weird?
Well, in those days, you know, that kind of went with being a poet. We have much more circumspect or straight-laced
poets. Wallace Stevens, not yeah. William.
Well, I think Wallace Stevens could, you know, have a few too many.
Of
Wasn't
course,
he drunk in Key West?
When Hemingway knocked him to the street,
yeah,
sure.
But no.
No, but he was a dull old three-piece insurance lawyer from Hartford.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, William Carlos Williams was a faithful doctor with his little black bag
around Patterson. Yes, and
Marianne
Moore, too. Abstemious these people were. I don't know, it was the mid-century. It was, the sexual revolution was upon us. There's a way, I think, that Bishop, although they had in some ways a common background, they were New Englanders, and both had trust funds that were helpful to them in making their way through life as poets. She was completely unarmed with family. I think Lowell had too much family, perhaps. Mm. He was burdened by it. And that's, you know, what came up when he wrote his life study. She said, all you have to do is write down the names, and there you have your poems. She didn't have anything like that. Her father had died when she was 8 months old. Her mother was institutionalized. From an early age, she really was an orphan. She had to figure out how to care for herself, which primarily meant finding people who would care for her.
Megan, what might Elizabeth Bishop say even today about what they had together? It was not sexual. It was not a marriage like Elizabeth Barrett and Robert Browning, but it was something sublime.
I think they were kind of, you know, twins in a way, you'd say. Their important first books came out the same year. They egged each other on towards the confessional to the extent that Bishop was willing to go, and certainly Lowell much farther. They were always checking in with each other. They helped each other as best they could. And she also wrote late in life to her doctor, who was a dear friend, I loved him second to Lotta. So it was a love that she counted as profound, even if it wasn't a romantic love exactly. Perhaps he was the family that she never had and so much needed. He was always there for her.
Megan Marshall won the Pulitzer Prize 3 years ago for her biography of Margaret Fuller, the pioneering woman in the Concord Circle around Ralph Waldo Emerson. And so we come to the poem For the Union Dead, so often cited even by Lowell himself as a distillation of his style and his thinking. Dense with images, it's the poet's reflection on the Boston Monument to the abolitionist Colonel Robert Gould Shaw and the 54th Massachusetts Regiment of Black Soldiers that Shaw organized and led to fight and mostly die in the Civil War. Lowell wrote For the Union Dead in 1959, when civil rights of black Americans were a rising battle, and when Lowell observed that the selflessness of Colonel Shaw and his troops stuck like a fishbone in Boston's throat. We wanted to hear the poem again in Lowell's own voice, but then also in a voice of Boston today, so we asked a Boston public school teacher, Somali-born Abdi Ali, to take up the reading. Outdoors at first, standing in front of the sculpted bronze monument that looks across Beacon Street to the Massachusetts State House. First Lowell, then Ali.
For the Union Dead. The old South Boston Aquarium stands in a Sahara of snow now. Its broken windows are boarded. The bronze weather vane cod has lost half its scales.
The airy tanks are dry. Once my nose crawled like a snail on the glass. My hand tingled to burst the bubbles drifting from the noses of the cowed, compliant fish. My hand draws back. I often sigh still for the dark, downward, and vegetating kingdom of the fish and reptile. One morning last March, I pressed against the new barbed and galvanized fence of the Boston Common. Behind their cage, yellow dinosaur steam shovels were grunting as they cropped up tons of mush and grass to gouge their underworld garage. Parking spaces luxuriate like civic sandpiles in the heart of Boston. A girdle of orange, Puritan pumpkin-colored girders braces the tingling state house, shaking over the excavations as it faces Colonel Shaw and his bell-cheeked Negro infantry on Satan Garden's shaking Civil War relief, propped by a plank splint against the garage's earthquake. 2 months after marching through Boston, half the regiment was dead. At the dedication, William James could almost hear the bronze Negroes breathe. Their monument sticks like a fishbone in the city's throat. Its colonel is as lean as a compass needle. He has an angry wren-like vigilance, a greyhound's gentle tautness. He seems to wince at pleasure and suffocate for privacy. He's out of bounds now. He rejoices in man's lovely peculiar power to choose life and die. When he leads his black soldiers to death, he cannot bend his back. On 1,000 small town New England greens, the old white churches hold their air of sparse, sincere rebellion. Frayed flags quilt the graveyards of the Grand Army of the Republic. The stone statues of the abstract Union soldier grow slimmer and younger each year. Wasp-waisted, they doze over muskets and muse through their sideburns. Shaw's father wanted no monument except the ditch, where his son's body was thrown and lost with his niggers. The ditch is nearer. There are no statues for the last war here. On Boylston Street, a commercial photograph shows Hiroshima boiling over a Mosler safe, the rock of ages that survived the blast. Space is nearer. When I crouch to my television set, the drained faces of Negro schoolchildren rise like balloons. Colonel Shaw is writing on his bubble. He waits for the blessed break. The aquarium is gone. Everywhere, giant finned cars nose forward like fish. A savage servility slides by on grease. I think the poem, for me, it is prescient. I've taught this poem to high school students in Boston Public Schools. I can't help but think about Beyond Vietnam by Martin Luther King. I've had students read both the poem and that essay together. In that speech, Martin Luther King talks about the three evils, racism, capitalism, and militarism. And I think in this, For the Union Dead, is an ode to those who have died because of these three evils. And I think Robert Lowell is making those connections.
Abdi Ali teaches in the experimental and inclusive Mission Hill School in Boston. And so the legacy of Robert Lowell and his native city keep unfolding together. For more nearly equal time with Elizabeth Bishop, do look for her on our website, radioopensource.org, and listen particularly to the Irishman Colm Tobin's uncanny reading of one Bishop masterpiece called simply Poem. On looking into a small painting of a scene that she grew up in Nova Scotia. Thank you, Abdi Ali, Megan Marshall, Kay Redfield Jameson, Dan Chasen, Steph Burt, and Colm Tobin. Thanks also to Michael Kumpsty, whose reading of Robert Lowell's letter to Libby Bishop was recorded at the 92nd Street Y in New York. Our show this week was produced by Zach Goldhammer, Frank Horton, Becca DiGregorio, and Susan Coyne. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.